Macmillan Audio presents Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less by Geoffrey Archer. Read for you by John Lee. To Mary and the Fat Men. Acknowledgements. I acknowledge all the help I received from so many people in writing this book and wish to thank them. David Niven Jr., who made me do it, Sir Noel and Lady Hall, who made it possible, Adrian Metcalf, Anthony Rentoul, Colin Empson, Ted Francis, Godfrey Barker, Willie West, Madame Telligan, David Stein, Christian Neff, Dr. John Vance, Dr. David Whedon, the Reverend Leslie Styler, Robert Gasser, Professor Jim Bolton and Jamie Clark, Gail and Joe for putting it together, and my wife Mary for the hours spent correcting and editing. Prologue. Jörg, expect $7 million from Crédit Parisien into number 2 accounts by 6 p.m. tonight, Central European time, and place it with first-class banks and AAA commercial names. Otherwise, invest it in the overnight euro-dollar market. Understood? Yes, Harvey. Place $1 million in the Banco Dominas Gerais, Rio de Janeiro, in the names of Silverman and Elliot, and cancel the call loan at Barclays Bank Lombard Street. Understood? Yes, Harvey. Buy gold on my commodity account until it reaches $10 million and then hold until you receive further instructions. Try and buy in the troughs, and don't rush. Be patient. Understood? Yes, Harvey. Harvey Metcalf realized that the last instruction was unnecessary. Jürg Bierer was one of the most conservative bankers in Zurich, and, more important to Harvey, had over the past 25 years proved to be one of the shrewdest. Can you join me at Wimbledon on Tuesday, June 25th at 2 p.m., Centre Court, my usual debenture seat? Yes, Harvey. The telephone clicked into place. Harvey never said goodbye. He had never understood the niceties of life, and it was too late to start learning now. He picked up the phone, dialed the 7 digits which would give him the Lincoln Trust in Boston, and asked for his secretary. Miss Fish? Yes, sir. Remove the file on Prospecto Oil and destroy it. Destroy any correspondence connected with it and leave absolutely no trace. Understood? Yes, sir. The telephone clicked again. Harvey Metcalf had given similar orders 3 times in the last 25 years, and by now Miss Fish had learned not to question him. Harvey breathed deeply, almost a sigh, a quiet exhalation of triumph. He was now worth at least $25 million, and nothing could stop him. He opened a bottle of Krug Champagne 1964, imported from Hedges and Butler of London. He sipped it slowly and lit a Romeo e Giulietta Churchill, which an Italian immigrant smuggled in for him in boxes of 250 once a month from Cuba. He settled back for a mild celebration. In Boston, Massachusetts, it was 12:20 p.m., nearly time for lunch. In Harley Street, Bond Street, the King's Road and Magdalen College, Oxford, it was 6:20 p.m. 4 men, unknown to each other, checked the market price of Prospector Oil in the final edition of the London Evening Standard. It was £3.70. All 4 of them were rich men, looking forward to consolidating their already successful careers. Tomorrow, they would be penniless. Chapter 1. Making a million legally has always been difficult. Making a million illegally has always been a little easier. Keeping a million when you have made it is perhaps the most difficult of all. Henry Metalski was one of those rare men who had managed all 3, even if the million he had made legally came after the million he had made illegally. Metalski was still a yard ahead of the others. He had managed to keep it all. Henry Metalski was born on the Lower East Side of New York on May 17th, 1909, in a small room that already slept 4 children. He grew up through the Depression, believing in God and one meal a day. His parents were from Warsaw and had emigrated from Poland at the turn of the century. Henrik's father was a baker by trade and had soon found a job in New York, where immigrant Poles specialized in baking black rye bread and running small restaurants for their countrymen. Both parents would have liked Henrik to be an academic success, but he was never destined to become an outstanding pupil at his high school. His natural gifts lay elsewhere. A cunning, smart little boy, he was far more interested in the control of the underground school market in cigarettes and liquor than in stirring tales of the American Revolution and the Liberty Bell. Little Henrik never believed for one moment that the best things in life were free, and the pursuit of money and power came as naturally to him as the pursuit of a mouse to a cat. When Henrik was a pimply and flourishing 14-year-old, his father died of what we now know to be cancer. His mother outlived her husband by no more than a few months, leaving the five children to fend for themselves. Henrik, like the other four, should have gone into the district orphanage for destitute children, but in the mid-1920s it was not hard for a boy to disappear in New York, though it was harder to survive. Henrik became a master of survival, a schooling which was to prove very useful to him in later life. He knocked around the Lower East Side with his belt tightened and his eyes open, shining shoes here, washing dishes there, always looking for an entrance to the maze at the heart of which lay wealth and prestige. His first chance came when his roommate, Jan Pelnik, a messenger boy on the New York Stock Exchange, put himself temporarily out of action with a sausage garnished with salmonella. Henrik, deputed to report his friend's mishap to the chief messenger, upgraded food poisoning to tuberculosis and talked himself into the ensuing vacancy. He then changed his room, donned a new uniform, lost a friend, and gained a job. Most of the messages Henrik delivered during the early 20s read, "Buy." Many of them were quickly acted upon, for this was a boom era. He watched men of little ability make fortunes, while he remained nothing more than an observer. His instincts directed him toward those individuals who made more money in a week on the stock exchange than he could hope to make in a lifetime on his salary. He set about learning how to master the way the stock exchange operated. He listened to private conversations, opened sealed messages, and found out which closed company reports to study. By the age of 18, he had 4 years' experience of Wall Street, 4 years which most messenger boys would have spent simply walking across crowded floors, delivering little pink pieces of paper, 4 years which, to Henrik Metelsky, were the equivalent of a master's degree from the Harvard Business School. He was not to know that one day he would lecture to that august body. One morning in July 1927, he was delivering a message from Halgarten and Company, a well-established brokerage house, making his usual detour via the washroom. He had perfected a system whereby he could lock himself into a cubicle, study the message he was carrying, decide whether the information was of any value to him, and if it was, immediately telephone Witold Gronowicz, an old Pole who managed a small insurance firm for his fellow countrymen. Henrik reckoned to pick up an extra $20 to $25 a week for the inside knowledge he supplied. Gronowicz, in no position to place large sums on the market, never let any of the leaks lead back to his young informant. Sitting on the lavatory seat, Henrik began to realize that this time he was reading a message of considerable importance. The governor of Texas was about to grant the Standard Oil Company permission to complete a pipeline from Chicago to Mexico, all other public bodies involved having already agreed to the proposal. The market was aware that the company had been trying to obtain this final permission for nearly a year, but the general view was that the governor would turn it down. The message was to be passed direct to John D. Rockefeller's broker, Tucker Anthony, immediately. The granting of this permission to build a pipeline would open up the entire North to a ready supply of oil, and that could only mean increased profits. It was obvious to Henrik that Standard Oil stock must rise steadily on the market once the news had broken, especially as Standard Oil already controlled 90% of the oil refineries in America. In normal circumstances, Henrik would have sent on this information direct to Mr. Gronowicz, and was about to do so when he noticed a rather overweight man, who was also leaving the washroom, drop a piece of paper. As there was no one else about at the time, Henrik picked it up and retreated back into his private cubicle, thinking that, at best, it would reveal another piece of information. In fact, it was a check for $50,000, made out to cash, from a Mrs. Rose Rennick. Henrik thought quickly and not on his feet. He left the washroom at speed and was soon standing outside on Wall Street itself. He made his way to a small coffee shop on Rector Street and sat there, pretending to drink a Coca-Cola while he carefully worked out his plan. He then proceeded to act on it. First, he cashed the check at a branch of the Morgan Bank on the southwest side of Wall Street, knowing that in his smart uniform as a messenger at the exchange, he would easily pass as a carrier for some distinguished firm. He then returned to the exchange and acquired from a floor broker 2,500 Standard Oil shares at $19.78, leaving himself $126.61 change after brokerage charges. He placed the $126.61 in a checking account with the Morgan Bank. Then, waiting in tense anticipation for an announcement from the governor's office, he put himself through the motions of a normal day's work, too preoccupied with Standard Oil even to make a detour via the washroom with the messages he carried. No announcement came. Henrik could not know that the news was being held up until the exchange had officially closed at 3 p.m., in order to allow the governor himself to buy shares anywhere and everywhere he could lay his grubby hands on them. Henrik went home that night, petrified that he had made a disastrous mistake. He had visions of losing his job and everything he had built up over the past 4 years. Perhaps he would even end up in jail. He was unable to sleep that night and became steadily more restless in his small open-windowed but airless room. At 1 a.m. he could stand the uncertainty no longer, so he jumped out of bed, shaved, dressed, and took a subway to Grand Central Station. From there he walked to Times Square, where, with trembling hands, he bought the first edition of the Wall Street Journal. For a moment he couldn't take in the news, although it was shrieking at him in banner headlines, "Governor grants oil pipeline rights to Rockefeller," and a secondary headline, "Heavy trading expected in Standard Oil shares." Dazed, Henrik walked to the nearest all-night cafe on West 42nd Street and ordered a large hamburger and french fries, which he covered in ketchup and nibbled at like a man eating his last breakfast before facing the electric chair, rather than his first on the way to fortune. He read the full details of Rockefeller's coup on page 1, which spread over to page 14, and by 4 a.m. he had bought the first 3 editions of the New York Times and the first 2 editions of the Herald Tribune. The lead story was the same in each. Henrik hurried home, giddy and elated, and changed into his uniform. He arrived at the stock exchange at 8 a.m. and went through the motions of a day's work, thinking only of how to carry out the second part of his plan. When the stock exchange opened officially, Henrik went over to the Morgan Bank and requested a loan of $50,000 against the security of his 2,500 Standard Oil shares, which had opened that morning at $21.25. He placed the loan in his checking account and instructed the bank to issue him a draft for the $50,000 to be made out to Mrs. Rose Rennick. He left the bank and looked up the address and telephone number of his unwitting benefactor. Mrs. Rennick, a widow who lived off the investments left by her late husband, lived in a small apartment on 62nd Street, which Henrik knew to be one of the most fashionable parts of New York. The call from a Henry Metelsky, asking to see her on an urgent private matter, came as something of a surprise to her, but a final mention of Halgarten and Company gave her a little more confidence, and she agreed to see him at the Waldorf Astoria at 4 p.m. that afternoon. Henrik had never been inside the Waldorf Astoria, but after 4 years on the stock exchange, there were few prominent hotels or restaurants he had not heard mentioned in other people's conversations. He realized that Mrs. Rennick was more likely to have tea with him there than to see a man with a name like Henry Metelsky in her own apartment, especially as his Polish accent was more pronounced over the telephone than it was face to face. As Henrik stood in the thickly carpeted lobby of the Waldorf, he blushed at his sartorial naivete. Imagining that everybody was staring at him, he buried his short, amply covered frame in an elegant chair in the Jefferson Room. Some of the other patrons of the Waldorf were amply covered too, but Henrik felt that pommes de terre maître d'hôtel were more likely to have caused their obesity than French fries. vainly wishing he had put a little less grease on his black wavy hair and a little more on his down-at-heel shoes, he scratched nervously at an irritating pustule on the side of his mouth and waited. His suit, in which he felt so assured and prosperous among his friends, was shiny, skimpy, cheap, and loud. He did not blend in with the decor, still less with the patrons of the hotel, and feeling inadequate for the first time in his life, he picked up a copy of The New Yorker, hid behind it, and prayed for his guest to arrive quickly. Waiters fluttered deferentially around the well-provended tables, ignoring Henrik with instinctive superciliousness. One, he noticed, did nothing more than circle the tea room delicately, proffering lump sugar from silver tongs in a white-gloved hand. Henrik was enormously impressed. Rose Rennick arrived a few minutes after four, accompanied by two small dogs and wearing an outrageously large hat. Henrik thought she looked over 60, overweight, over-made up and overdressed, but she had a warm smile and appeared to know everyone as she moved from table to table, chatting to the regular Waldorf Astoria set. Eventually reaching what she had rightly assumed to be Henrik's table, she was rather taken aback, not only to find him so strangely dressed, but also looking even younger than his 18 years. Mrs. Rennick ordered tea while Henrik recited his well-rehearsed story. There had been an unfortunate mistake with her check, which had been wrongly credited to his firm at the stock exchange on the previous day. His boss had instructed him to return the check immediately and to say how much they regretted the unfortunate error. Henrik then passed over the draft for $50,000 and added that he would lose his job if she insisted on taking the matter any further, as he had been entirely responsible for the mistake. Mrs. Rennick had, in fact, only been informed of the missing check that morning and did not realize that it had been cashed, as it would have taken a few days to clear her account. Henrik's perfectly genuine anxiety, as he stumbled through his tale, would have convinced a far more critical observer of human nature than Mrs. Rennick. Readily she agreed to let the matter drop, only too pleased to have her money returned. As it was in the form of a draft from the Morgan Bank, she had lost nothing. Henrik breathed a sigh of relief, and for the first time that day began to relax and enjoy himself. He even called for the waiter with the sugar and silver tongs. After a respectable period of time had passed, Henrik explained that he must return to work, thanked Mrs. Rennick for her cooperation, paid the bill and left. Outside on the street, he whistled with relief. His new shirt was soaked in sweat. Mrs. Rennick would have called it perspiration. But he was out in the open and could breathe freely again. His first major operation had been a success. He stood on Park Avenue, amused that the venue for his confrontation with Mrs. Rennick had been the Waldorf, the very hotel where John D. Rockefeller, the president of Standard Oil, had a suite. Henrik had arrived on foot and used the main entrance, while Mr. Rockefeller had earlier arrived by subway and taken his private lift to the Waldorf Towers. Although few New Yorkers were aware of it, Rockefeller had had his own private station built 50 feet below the Waldorf Astoria to save him travelling the 8 blocks to Grand Central Station, there being no stop between there and 125th Street. The station remains to this day, but as no Rockefellers live at the Waldorf Astoria, the train never stops there. While Henrik had been discussing his $50,000 with Mrs. Rennick, Rockefeller had been considering an investment of $5 million with Andrew W. Mellon, President Coolidge's Secretary of the Treasury, 57 floors above him. The next morning, Henrik returned to work as usual. He knew he had only 5 days' grace to sell the shares and clear his debt with the Morgan Bank and the stockbroker, as an account on the New York Stock Exchange runs for 5 business days, or 7 calendar days. On the last day of the account, the shares were standing at 23 1/4. He sold at 23 1/8 and cleared his overdraft of $49,625 and, after expenses, realized a profit of $7,490, which he left deposited with the Morgan Bank. Over the next 3 years, Henrik stopped ringing Mr. Gronovich and started dealing for himself, in small amounts to begin with, but growing larger as he gained in experience and confidence. Times were still good, and while he didn't always make a profit, He had learned to master the occasional bear market as well as the more common bull. His system in the bear market was to sell short, not a practice considered to be entirely ethical in business. He soon mastered the art of selling shares he didn't own in expectation of a subsequent fall in their price. His instinct for market trends refined as rapidly as did his taste for clothes, and the guile learned in the back streets of the Lower East Side always stood him in good stead. Henrik soon discovered that the whole world was a jungle. Sometimes the lions and tigers wore suits. When the stock market collapsed in 1929, Henrik had turned his $7,490 into $51,000 of liquid assets, having sold on every share he possessed the day after the chairman of Halgarten and Company jumped out of one of the stock exchange windows. Henrik had got the message. With his newly acquired income, he had moved into a smart apartment in Brooklyn and started driving a rather ostentatious red Stutz. Henrik realized at an early age that he had come into the world with three main disadvantages: his name, background, and impecunity. The money problem was solving itself, so he decided the time had come to expunge the other two. To that end, he had made an application to change his name by court order to Harvey David Metcalf. When the application was granted, he ceased all further contact with his old friends from the Polish community, and in May 1930 he came of age with a new name and a new background. It was later that year at a football game that he first met Roger Sharpley, and discovered that the rich have their problems too. Sharpley, a young man from Boston, had inherited his father's company, which specialized in the import of whiskey and the export of furs. Educated at Choate and later in Dartmouth College, Sharpley had all the assurance and charm of the Boston set, so often envied by his fellow countrymen. He was tall and fair, looked as if he came from Viking stock, and with his air of the gifted amateur, found most things came easily to him, especially women. He was in every way a total contrast to Harvey. Although they were poles apart, the contrast acted like a magnet and attracted the one to the other. Roger's only ambition in life was to become an officer in the Navy, but after graduating from Dartmouth, he had had to return to the family business because of his father's ill health. He had only been with the firm a few months when his father died. Roger would have liked to have sold Sharpley and Son to the first bidder, but his father had made a codicil to his will to the effect that if the firm was sold before Roger's 40th birthday, that being the last day one can enlist for the U.S. Navy, the money gained from the sale would be divided equally among his other relatives. Harvey gave Roger's problem considerable thought, and after two lengthy sessions with a skillful New York lawyer, suggested a course of action to Roger. Harvey would purchase 49% of Sharpley and Son for $100,000 and the first $20,000 profit each year. At the age of 40, Roger could relinquish the remaining 51% for a further $100,000. The board would consist of three voting members: Harvey, Roger, and one nominated by Harvey, giving him overall control. As far as Harvey was concerned, Roger could join the Navy and need only attend the annual shareholders' meeting. Roger could not believe his luck. He did not even consult anyone at Sharpley and Son, knowing only too well that they would try to talk him out of it. Harvey had counted on this and had assessed his quarry accurately. Roger gave the proposition only a few days' consideration before allowing the legal papers to be drawn up in New York, far enough away from Boston to be sure the firm did not learn what was going on. Meanwhile, Harvey returned to the Morgan Bank, where he was now looked upon as a man with a future. Since banks deal in futures, the manager agreed to help him in his new enterprise, with a loan of $50,000 to add to his own $50,000, enabling Harvey to acquire 49% of Sharpley and Son and become its fifth president. The legal documents were signed in New York on October 28, 1930. Roger left speedily for Newport, Rhode Island, to commence his officer's training program in the U.S. Navy. Harvey left for Grand Central Station to catch the train for Boston. His days as a messenger boy on the New York Stock Exchange were over. He was 21 years of age and the president of his own company. What looked like disaster to most, Harvey could always turn into triumph. The American people were still suffering under Prohibition, and although Harvey could export furs, he could no longer import whiskey. This had been the main reason for the fall in the company profits over the past decade. But Harvey soon found that with a little bribery, involving the mayor of Boston, the chief of police, and the customs officials on the Canadian border, plus a payment to the mafia to ensure that his products reached the restaurants and speakeasies, somehow the whiskey imports went up rather than down. Sharpley and Son lost its more respectable and long-serving staff and replaced them with animals better suited to Harvey Metcalfe's particular jungle. From 1930 to 1933, Harvey went from strength to strength, but when Prohibition was finally lifted by President Roosevelt, after overwhelming public demand, the excitement went with it. Harvey allowed the company to continue to deal in whiskey and furs while he branched out into new fields. In 1933, Sharpley and Son celebrated 100 years in business. In 3 years, Harvey had lost 97 years of goodwill and doubled the profits. It took him 5 years to reach his first million, and only another 4 to double the sum again, which was when he decided the time had come for Harvey Metcalfe and Sharpley and Son to part company. In 12 years, from 1930 to 1942, he had built up the profits from $30,000 to $910,000. He sold the company in January 1944 for $7 million, paying $100,000 to the widow of Captain Roger Sharpley of the U.S. Navy and keeping $6,900,000 for himself. Harvey celebrated his 35th birthday by buying, at a cost of $4 million, a small ailing bank in Boston called the Lincoln Trust. At the time, it boasted a profit of approximately $500,000 a year, a prestigious building in the center of Boston, and an unblemished and somewhat boring reputation. Harvey intended to change both its reputation and its balance sheet. He enjoyed being the president of a bank, but it did nothing to improve his honesty. Every dubious deal in the Boston area seemed to emanate from the Lincoln Trust, and although Harvey increased the bank's profits to $2 million per annum during the next 5 years, his personal reputation was never in credit. Harvey met Arlene Hunter in the winter of 1949. She was the only daughter of the president of the First City Bank of Boston. Until then, Harvey had never taken any real interest in women. His driving force had always been making money. And although he considered the opposite sex a useful relaxation in his free time, on balance he found them an inconvenience. But having now reached what the glossy magazines referred to as middle age, and having no heir to leave his fortune to, he calculated that it was time to find a wife who would present him with a son. As with everything else that he had wanted in his life, he considered the problem very carefully. Harvey had first run into Arlene when she was 31, quite literally, when she had backed her car into his new Lincoln. She could not have been a greater contrast to the short, uneducated, overweight Pole. She was nearly 6 feet tall, slim, and although not unattractive, she lacked confidence and was beginning to think that marriage had passed her by. Most of her school friends were already on their second divorces and felt rather sorry for her. Harvey's extravagant ways came as a welcome change after her parents' prudish discipline, which she often felt was to blame for her awkwardness with men of her own age. She had only had one affair, a disastrous failure, thanks to her total innocence, and until Harvey arrived, no one had seemed to be willing to give her a second chance. Arlene's father did not approve of Harvey and showed it, which only made him more attractive to her. Her father had not approved of any of the men she had associated with, but on this occasion he was right. Harvey, on the other hand, realized that to marry the First City Bank of Boston with the Lincoln Trust could only be of long-term benefit to him, and with that in mind he set out, as he always did, to conquer. Arlene didn't put up much of a battle. Arlene and Harvey were married in 1951 at a wedding more memorable for those who were absent than those who attended. They settled into Harvey's Lincoln home outside of Boston, and very shortly afterward, Arlene announced she was pregnant. She gave Harvey a daughter almost a year to the day after their marriage. They christened her Rosalie, and she became the center of Harvey's attention. His only disappointment came when a prolapse, closely followed by a hysterectomy, prevented Arlene from bearing him any more children. He sent Rosalie to Bennett's, the most expensive girls' school in Washington, and from there she was accepted at Vassar to major in English. This even pleased old man Hunter, who had grown to tolerate Harvey and adore his granddaughter. On gaining her degree, Rosalie continued her education at the Sorbonne. After a fierce disagreement with her father concerning the type of friends she was keeping, particularly the ones with long hair who didn't want to go to Vietnam. Not that Harvey had done much during the Second World War, except to cash in on every shortage. The final crunch came when Rosalie dared to suggest that morals were not to be decided only by length of hair or political views. Harvey missed her, but refused to admit the fact to Arlene. Harvey had three loves in his life. The first was still Rosalie, the second was his paintings, and the third his orchids. The first had started the moment his daughter was born. The second was a love that had developed over many years, and had been kindled in the strangest way. A client of Sharpley and Son was about to go bankrupt while still owing a fairly large sum of money to the company. Harvey got wind of it, and went around to confront him. But the rot had already set in, and there was no longer any hope of securing cash. Determined not to leave empty-handed, Harvey took with him the man's only tangible asset, a Renoir, valued at $10,000. Harvey's intention was to sell the picture quickly before it could be proved that he was a preferred creditor, but he became so entranced with the fine brushwork and the delicate pastel shades that his only desire was to own more. When he realized that pictures were not only a good investment, but that he actually liked them as well, his collection and his love grew hand in hand. By the early 1970s, Harvey had a Manet, two Monets, a Renoir, two Picassos, a Pissarro, a Utrillo, a Cézanne, as well as most of the recognized lesser names, and he had become quite a connoisseur of the Impressionist period. His one remaining desire was to possess a Van Gogh, and only recently he had failed to acquire L'Hôpital de Saint-Paul à Saint-Rémy at the Sotheby Park Burnett Gallery in New York, when Dr. Armand Hammer of Occidental Petroleum had outbid him. $1,200,000 had been just a little too much for Harvey. Earlier, in 1966, he had failed to acquire Lot 49, Mademoiselle Ravoux, from Christie, Manson and Woods, the London art dealers. Although the Reverend Theodore Pitcairn, representing the Lord's New Church in Brynathyn, Pennsylvania, had pushed him over the top, he had only whetted his appetite further. The Lord giveth, and on that occasion the Lord had taken away. Although it was not fully appreciated in Boston, it was already recognized in the art world that Harvey had one of the finest Impressionist collections in the world, almost as widely admired as that of Walter Annenberg, President Nixon's ambassador to London, who, like Harvey, had been one of the few people to build up a major collection since the Second World War. Harvey's third love was his prize collection of orchids, and he had three times been a winner at the New England Spring Flower Show in Boston, twice beating old man Hunter into second place. Harvey now travelled to Europe once a year. He had established a successful stud in Kentucky and liked to see his horses run at Longchamp and Ascot. He also enjoyed watching Wimbledon, which he considered was still the greatest tennis tournament in the world. It amused him to do a little business in Europe at the same time, giving him the opportunity to make some more money for his Swiss bank account in Zurich. He did not need a Swiss account, but somehow he got a kick out of doing Uncle Sam. Although Harvey had mellowed over the years and cut down on his more dubious deals, he could never resist the chance to take a risk if he thought the reward was likely to be big enough. One such golden opportunity presented itself in 1964, when Her Majesty's government invited applications for exploration and production licenses in the North Sea. At that time, neither the British government nor the civil servants involved had any idea of the future significance of North Sea oil, or the role it would eventually play in British politics. If the government had known that in 1978 the Arabs would be holding a pistol to the heads of the rest of the world, and the British House of Commons would have 11 Scottish nationalist members of Parliament, it would surely have reacted in a totally different way. On May 13, 1964, the Secretary of State for Power laid before Parliament Statutory Instruments, No. 708, Continental Shelf, Petroleum. Harvey read this particular document with great interest, thinking that it might well be a means of making an exceptional killing. He was particularly fascinated by paragraph 4 of the document, which read, "Persons who are citizens of the United Kingdom and colonies, and are resident in the United Kingdom, or who are bodies corporate incorporated in the United Kingdom, may apply in accordance with these regulations for A. a production license, or B. an exploration license." When he had studied the regulations in their entirety, he had to sit back and think hard. Only a small amount of money was required to secure a production and exploration license. As paragraph 6 went on to point out, 1. With every application for a production license, there shall be paid a fee of £200, with an additional fee of £5 for every block after the first 10 in respect whereof that application is made. 2. With every application for an exploration license, there shall be paid a fee of £20. Harvey couldn't believe it. How easy it would be to use such a license to create the impression of a vast enterprise. For a few $100, he could be alongside such names as Shell, BP, Total, Gulf, and Occidental. Harvey went over the regulations again and again, hardly believing that the British government could release such potential for so small an investment. Only the application form, an elaborate and exacting document, now stood in his way. Harvey was not a British subject, none of his companies was British, and he realized he would have problems of presentation. He decided that his application must therefore be backed by a British bank, and that he would set up a company whose directors would win the confidence of the British government. With this in mind, early in 1964, he registered at Companies House in England a firm called Prospector Oil, using Malcolm, Botnick and Davis as his solicitors, and Barclays Bank, who were already the Lincoln Trust's representative in Europe, as his bankers. Lord Honeysett became chairman of the company, and several distinguished public figures joined the board, including two ex-members of Parliament, who had lost their seats when the Labour Party won the 1964 election. Prospector Oil issued 2,010,000 shares at £1, which were all taken up for Harvey by nominees. He also deposited $500,000 in the Lombard Street branch of Barclays Bank. Having thus created the front, Harvey then used Lord Honeysett to apply for the license from the British government. The new Labour government, elected in October 1964, was no more aware of the significance of North Sea Oil than the earlier Conservative administration. The government's requirements for a license were a rent of £12,000 a year for the first 6 years, 12.5% revenue tax, and a further capital gains tax on profits. But as Harvey's plan was to reap profits for himself rather than the company, that presented no problems. On May 22, 1965, the Minister of Power published in the London Gazette the name of Prospector Oil among the 52 companies granted production licences. On August 3, 1965, Statutory Instrument Number 1531 allocated the actual areas. Prospector Oil's was 51 degrees 50 minutes north, 2 degrees 30 minutes 20 seconds east, a site adjacent to one of BP's holdings. Then Harvey sat back, waiting for one of the companies which had acquired North Sea sites to strike oil. It was a longish wait, but Harvey was in no hurry, and not until June 1970 did BP make a big commercial strike in their Forties field. BP had already spent over $1 billion in the North Sea, and Harvey was determined to be one of the main beneficiaries. He was now on to another winner, and immediately set the second part of his plan in motion. Early in 1972, he hired an oil rig which, with much flourish and advance publicity, he had towed out to the Prospector Oil site. Having hired the rig on the basis of being able to renew the contract if he made a successful strike, he engaged the minimum number of workers allowed by the government regulations and then proceeded to drill to 6,000 feet. After this drilling had been completed, he released from the company's employment all those involved, but told Redding and Bates, from whom he had rented the rig, that he would be requiring it again in the near future, and therefore would continue to pay the rental. Harvey then released Prospector Oil shares onto the market at the rate of a few thousand a day for the next 2 months, all from his own stock, and whenever the financial journalists of the British press rang to ask why those shares were steadily rising, The young public relations officer at Prospector Oil's city office would say, as briefed, that he had no comment to make at present, but there would be a press statement in the near future. Some newspapers put two and two together and made about 15. The shares climbed steadily from 10 pence to nearly £2 under the guidance of Harvey's chief executive in Britain, Bernie Silverman, who, with his long experience of this kind of operation, was only too aware of what his boss was up to. Silverman's main task was to ensure that nobody could show a direct connection between Metcalfe and Prospector Oil. In January 1974, the shares stood at £3. It was then that Harvey was ready to move on to the third part of his plan. Using Prospector Oil's enthusiastic new recruit, a young Harvard graduate called David Kessler, as the fall guy. Chapter 2. Davis pushed his glasses back onto the bridge of his nose and read the advertisement in the business section of the Boston Globe again, to make sure he was not dreaming. It could have been tailor-made for him. Oil company based in Great Britain, carrying out extensive work in the North Sea off Scotland, requires a young executive with experience in the stock market and/or financial marketing. Salary, $25,000 a year. Accommodation supplied. Based in London. Apply box number 217A. Knowing it could lead to other openings in an expanding industry, David thought it sounded like a challenge, and wondered if they would consider him experienced enough. He recalled what his tutor in European affairs used to say, "If you must work in Great Britain, better make it the North Sea. With their union problems, there's nothing else great about the country." David Kessler was a lean, clean-shaven young American, with a crew cut which would have been better suited to a lieutenant in the Marines, a fresh complexion, and an unquenchable earnestness. David wanted to succeed in business with all the fervour of the new Harvard Business School graduate. He had spent 6 years in all at Harvard, the first four studying mathematics for his bachelor degree, and the last two across the Charles River at the business school. Recently graduated and armed with a BA and an MBA, he was looking for a job that would reward him for the exceptional capacity for hard work he knew he possessed. Never a brilliant scholar, he envied those natural academics among his classmates, who mastered post-Keynesian economic theories like children learning their multiplication tables. David had worked ferociously for 6 years, only lifting his nose far enough from the grindstone to fit in a daily workout at the gymnasium, and the occasional weekend watching Harvard jocks defending the honour of the university on the football field or on the basketball court. He would have enjoyed playing himself, but that would have meant less time for study. He read the advertisement again, and then typed a carefully prepared letter to the box number. A few days passed before a reply came, summoning him for an interview at a local hotel on the following Wednesday at 3 o'clock. David arrived at 2:45 p.m. at the Copley Hotel on Huntingdon Avenue, the adrenaline pumping through his body. He repeated the Harvard Business School motto to himself as he was ushered into a small private room. "Look British, think Yiddish." Three men, who introduced themselves as Silverman, Cooper, and Elliot, interviewed him. Bernie Silverman, a short, grey-haired, check-tied New Yorker with a solid aura of success, was in charge. Cooper and Elliot sat and watched David silently. Silverman spent a considerable time giving David an enticing description of the company's background and its future aims. Harvey had trained Silverman carefully, and he had at his well-manicured fingertips all the glib expertise needed by the right-hand man in a Metcalfe coup. "So there you have it, Mr. Kessler. We're involved in one of the biggest commercial opportunities in the world. Drilling for oil in the North Sea off Scotland. Our company, Prospector Oil, has the backing of a group of banks in America. We have been granted licenses from the British government and we have the financing. But companies are made not by money, Mr. Kessler, but by people. It's as simple as that. We're looking for a man who will work night and day to help put Prospector Oil on the map, and we'll pay the right man a top salary to do just that. If we offer you the position, you'll be working in our London office under the immediate direction of our managing director, Mr. Elliot." "Where are the company headquarters?" "New York, but we have offices in Montreal, San Francisco, London, Aberdeen, Paris, and Brussels. Is the company looking for oil anywhere else? Not at the moment, answered Silverman. We're sinking millions into the North Sea after BP's successful strike, and the fields around us have so far had a 1 in 5 success ratio, which is very high in our business. When would you want the successful applicant to start? Sometime in January, when he's completed a government training course on management in oil, said Richard Elliott. The slim, sallow number two sounded as if he was from Georgia. The government course was a typical Harvey Metcalf touch, maximum credibility for minimum expense. And the company apartment, said David. Where's that? Cooper spoke. You'll have one of the company flats in the Barbican, a few hundred yards away from our London city office. David had no more questions. Silverman had covered everything and seemed to know exactly what he wanted. 10 days later, David received a telegram inviting him to join Silverman for lunch at the 21 Club in New York. When David arrived at the restaurant, he recognized a host of well-known faces at nearby tables and felt new confidence. His host obviously knew what he was about. Their table was in one of the small alcoves selected by businessmen who prefer their conversations to remain confidential. Silverman was genial and relaxed. He stretched the conversation out a little, discussing irrelevancies, but finally, over a brandy, offered David the position in London. David was delighted. $25,000 a year, and the chance to be involved with a company which obviously had such an exciting future. He did not hesitate in agreeing to start his new appointment in London on January 1st. David Kessler had never been to England before. How green the grass was, how narrow the roads, how closed in by hedges and fences were the houses. It felt like Toy Town after the vast highways and large automobiles of New York. The small flat in the Barbican was clean and impersonal, and, as Mr. Cooper had said, convenient for the office a few hundred yards away in Threadneedle Street. Prospectors' offices consisted of 7 rooms on one floor of a large Victorian building. Silverman's was the only office with a prestigious air about it. There was a tiny reception area, a telex room, 2 rooms for secretaries, a larger room for Mr. Elliott, and another small one for himself. It seemed very pokey to David, but as Silverman was quick to point out, office rent in the City of London was $30 a square foot, compared with $10 in New York. Bernie Silverman's secretary, Judith Lampson, ushered David through to the well-appointed office of the chief executive. Silverman sat in a large black swivel chair behind a massive desk, which made him look like a midget. By his side were positioned 4 telephones, 3 white and 1 red. David was later to learn that the important-looking red telephone was directly connected to a number in the States, but he never actually discovered to whom.
"Good morning, Mr. Silverman. Where would you like me to start?"
"Bernie, please call me Bernie. Take a seat. Notice the change in the price of the company shares in the last few days?"
"Oh, yes," enthused David, "up a half to nearly $6.
I suppose it's because of our new bank backing and the other company's successful strikes?"
"No,"
said Silverman, in a low tone designed to give the impression that no one else must hear this part of the conversation. "The truth is that we've made a big strike ourselves, but we haven't yet decided when to announce it. It's all in this geologist's report." He threw a smart, colorful document over his desk. David whistled under his breath.
"What are the company's plans at the moment?"
"We'll announce the strike," said Silverman quietly, picking at his India rubber as he talked, "in about 3 weeks' time, when we're certain of the full extent and capacity of the whole. We want to make some plans for coping with the publicity and the sudden inflow of money. The shares will go through the roof, of course."
"The shares have already climbed steadily. Perhaps some people already know?"
"I guess that's right," said Silverman. "The trouble with that black stuff is once it comes out of the ground, you can't hide it." Silverman laughed.
"Is there any harm in getting in on the act?" asked David.
"No, as long as it doesn't harm the company in any way. Just let me know if anyone wants to invest. We don't have the problems of inside information in England, none of the restrictive laws we have in America."
"How high do you think the shares will go?"
Silverman looked him straight in the eye and then said casually, $20.
Back in his own office, David carefully read the geologist's report that Silverman had given him. It certainly looked as if Prospector Oil had made a successful strike, but the extent of the find was not as yet entirely certain. When he had completed the report, he glanced at his watch and cursed. The geologist's file had totally absorbed him. He threw the report into his briefcase and took a taxi to Paddington Station, only just making the 6:15 train. He was due in Oxford for dinner with an old classmate from Harvard. On the train down to the university city, he thought about Stephen Bradley, who had been a friend in his Harvard days, and had generously helped David and other students in mathematics classes that year. Stephen, now a visiting fellow at Magdalen College, was undoubtedly one of the most brilliant scholars of David's generation. He had won the Kennedy Memorial Scholarship to Harvard, and later, in 1970, the Wister Prize for Mathematics, the most sought-after award in the mathematical faculty. Although in monetary terms this award was a derisory $80 and a medal, it was the reputation and job offers it brought with it that made the competition so keen. Stephen had won it with consummate ease, and nobody was surprised when he was successful in his application for a fellowship at Oxford. He was now in his third year of research at Magdalen. His papers on Boolean algebra appeared at short intervals in the proceedings of the London Mathematical Society, and it had just been announced that he had been elected to a chair in mathematics back at his alma mater, Harvard, to commence in the fall. The 6:15 train from Paddington arrived in Oxford an hour later, and the short taxi ride from the station down New College Lane brought him to Magdalen at 7:30. One of the college porters escorted David to Stephen's rooms, which were spacious, ancient, and comfortably cluttered with books, cushions, and prints. How unlike the antiseptic walls of Harvard, thought David. Stephen was there to greet him. He didn't seem to have changed one iota. His suit seemed to hang off his tall, thin, ungainly body. No tailor would ever have employed him as a dummy. His heavy eyebrows protruded over his out-of-date round-rimmed spectacles, which he almost seemed to hide behind in his shyness. He ambled over to David and welcomed him, one minute as an old man, the next younger than his 30 years. Stephen poured David a Jack Daniels and they settled down to chat. Although Stephen never looked upon David as a close friend at Harvard, he had enjoyed coaching him and always found him eager to learn. Besides, he always welcomed an excuse to entertain Americans at Oxford. "It's been a memorable 3 years, David," said Stephen, pouring him a second drink. "The only sad event was the death of my father last winter. He took such an interest in my life at Oxford and gave my academic work so much support. He's left me rather well off, actually. Bath plugs were obviously more in demand than I realized. You might be kind enough to advise me on how to invest some of the money, because at the moment it's just sitting on deposit in the bank. I never seem to have the time to do anything about it, and when it comes to investments, I haven't a clue." That started David off about his demanding new job with Prospector Oil. "Why don't you invest your money in my company, Stephen? We've had a fantastic strike in the North Sea, and when they announce it, the shares are going to go through the roof. The whole operation would only take a month or so, and you could make the killing of a lifetime. I only wish I had some of my own money to put into it. Have you had the full details of the strike?" "No, but I've seen the geologist's report, and that makes pretty good reading. The shares are already going up fast, and I'm convinced they'll reach $20. The problem is that time is already running out." Stephen glanced at the geologist's report, thinking he would study it carefully later. "How does one go about an investment of this sort?" he asked. "Well, you find a respectable stockbroker, buy as many shares as you can afford, and then wait for the strike to be announced. I'll keep you informed on how things are going and advise you when I feel is the best time to sell." "That would be extremely thoughtful of you, David. It's the least I can do after all the help you gave me with math at Harvard." "Oh, that was nothing. Let's go and have some dinner." Stephen led David to the college dining hall, an oblong, oak-panelled room covered in pictures of past presidents of Magdalen, bishops, and academics. The long wooden tables at which the undergraduates were eating filled the body of the hall, but Stephen shuffled up to the high table and offered David a more comfortable seat. The students were a noisy, enthusiastic bunch. Stephen didn't notice them, but David was enjoying the whole experience. The seven-course meal was formidable, and David wondered how Stephen kept so thin with such daily temptations. When they reached the port, Stephen suggested they return to his rooms rather than join the crusty old dons in the senior common room. Late into the night, over the rubicund Magdalen port, they talked about North Sea oil and Boolean algebra, each admiring the other for his mastery of his subject. Stephen, like most academics, was fairly credulous outside the bounds of his own discipline. He began to think that an investment in Prospector Oil would be a very astute move on his part. In the morning, they strolled down Addison's Walk near Magdalen Bridge, where the grass grows green and lush by the Cherwell. Reluctantly, David caught a taxi at 9:45, leaving Magdalen behind him and passing New College, Trinity, Balliol, and finally Worcester, where he saw scrawled across the college wall, "C'est magnifique, mais ce n'est pas la gare." He caught the 10 a.m. train back to London. He had enjoyed his stay at Oxford, and hoped he had been able to help his old Harvard friend, who had done so much for him in the past. "Good morning, David."
"Good morning, Bernie. I thought I ought to let you know I spent the evening with a friend at Oxford, and he may invest some money in the company. It might be as much as $250,000. "That's fine, David. Keep up the good work. You're doing a great job."
Silverman showed no surprise at David's news, but once back in his own office, he picked up the red telephone.
"Harvey?"
"Yes?"
"Kessler seems to have been the right choice. He may have talked a friend of his into investing $250,000 in the company."
"Good. Now listen carefully. Brief my broker to put 40,000 shares on the market at just over $6 a share. If Kessler's friend does decide to invest in the company, mine will be the only large block of shares immediately available."
After a further day's consideration, Stephen noticed that the shares of Prospector Oil moved from £2.75 to £3.05, and decided the time had come to invest in what he was now convinced must be a winner. He trusted David, and had been impressed by the glossy geologist's report. He rang Kitcat and Aitken, a firm of stockbrokers in the city, and instructed them to buy $250,000 worth of shares in Prospector Oil. Harvey Metcalf's broker released 40,000 shares when Stephen's request came onto the floor of the stock exchange, and the transaction was quickly completed. Stephen's purchase price was £3.10. After investing his father's inheritance, Stephen spent the next few days happily watching the shares climb to £3.50, even before the expected announcement. Though Stephen didn't realize it, it was his own investment that had caused the shares to rise. He began to wonder what he would spend the profit on even before he had realized it. He decided not to cash in immediately, but hold on. David thought the shares would reach $20, and in any case, he had promised to tell him when to sell. Meanwhile, Harvey Metcalf began to release a few more shares onto the market because of the interest created by Stephen's investment. He was beginning to agree with Silverman that David Kessler, young, honest, and with all the enthusiasm of a man in his first appointment, had been an excellent choice. It was not the first time Harvey had used this ploy, keeping himself well away from the action, while placing the responsibility on inexperienced, innocent shoulders. At the same time, Richard Elliott, acting as the company spokesman, leaked stories to the press about large buyers coming into the market, which in itself occasioned a flood of small investors and kept the price steady. One lesson a man learns in the Harvard Business School is that an executive is only as good as his health. David never felt happy without a regular medical checkup. He rather enjoyed being told he was in good shape, but perhaps should take things a little easier. His secretary, Miss Rentoul, had therefore made an appointment for him with a Harley Street doctor. Dr. Robin Oakley was by anyone's standards a successful man. At 37, he was tall and handsome, with a head of dark hair that looked as if it would never recede. He had a classic strong face, and the self-assurance that came from proven success. He still played squash twice a week, which helped him look enviably younger than his contemporaries. Robin had remained fit since his Cambridge days, which he left with a rugby blue and an upper second-class degree. He had gone on to complete his medical training at St. Thomas's, where once again his rugby football, rather than his medical skill, brought him into prominence with those who decide the future careers of young men. When he qualified,
He went to work as an assistant to a highly successful Harley Street practitioner, Dr. Eugene Moffat. Dr. Moffat was successful not so much in curing the sick as in charming the rich, especially middle-aged women, who came to see him again and again. However little seemed to be wrong with them, at 50 guineas a visit, that had to be regarded as success. Moffat had chosen Robin Oakley as his assistant for exactly those qualities which he himself displayed, and which had made him so sought after. Robin Oakley was unquestionably good-looking, personable, well-educated, and just clever enough. Robin settled very well into Harley Street and the Moffat system, and when the older man died suddenly in his early 60s, he took over his mantle with the ease with which a crown prince would take over a throne. Robin continued to build up the practice, losing none of Moffat's ladies other than by natural causes, and did remarkably well for himself. He had a wife and two sons, a comfortable country house a few miles outside Newbury in Berkshire, and a considerable saving in blue-chip securities. He never complained at his good fortune and enjoyed life, at the same time being, he had to confess, a little bored with it all. He was beginning to find that the bland role of sympathetic doctor was almost intolerably cloying. Would the world come to an end if he admitted that he neither knew nor cared just what was causing the minute patches of dermatitis on Lady Fiona Fisher's diamond-studded hands? Would the heavens descend if he told the dreaded Mrs. Page Stanley that she was a malodorous old woman in need of nothing more medically taxing than a new set of dentures? And would he be struck off if he personally administered to the nubile Miss Lydia de Villiers a good dose of what she so clearly indicated she desired? David Kessler arrived on time for his appointment. He had been warned by Miss Rentoul that in England, doctors and dentists cancel if you are late and still charge you. He stripped and lay on Robin Oakley's couch. The doctor took his blood pressure, listened to his heart, and made him put out his tongue, an organ that seldom stands up well to public scrutiny. As he tapped and poked his way over David's body, they chatted. "What brings you to work in London, Mr. Kessler? I'm with an oil company in the city. I expect you've heard of us. Prospector Oil?" "No," said Robin. "Can't say I have. Bend your legs up, please." He hit David's kneecap smartly, one after the other, with a patella hammer. The legs jumped wildly. "Nothing wrong with those reflexes?" "You will, Dr. Oakley, you will. Things are going very well for us. Watch out for our progress in the papers." "Why?" said Robin, smiling. "Struck oil, have you?" "Yes," said David quietly, pleased with the impression he was creating. "As a matter of fact, we've done just that." Robin prodded David's abdomen for a few seconds. "Good muscular wall, not fat. No sign of an enlarged liver. Young man, you're in good physical shape." Robin left him in the examination room to get dressed and thoughtfully wrote out a brief report on Kessler for his records, while his mind dwelt on deeper things, an oil strike. Harley Street doctors, although they routinely keep private patients waiting for 3/4 of an hour in a gas-fired waiting room equipped with one out-of-date copy of Punch, never let them feel rushed once they are in the consulting room. Robin had no intention of rushing Mr. Kessler. "There's very little wrong with you, Mr. Kessler. Some signs of anemia, which I suspect are caused by nothing more than overwork and your recent rushing about. I'm going to give you some iron tablets, which should quickly take care of that. Take 2 a day, morning and night." He scribbled an illegible prescription for the tablets and handed it to David. "Many thanks. It's kind of you to give me so much of your time." "Not at all. How are you finding London?" asked Robin. "Very different from America, I expect." "Sure. The pace is much slower. Once I've mastered how long it takes to get something done here, I'll be halfway to victory." "Do you have many friends in London?" "No," replied David. "I have one or two buddies at Oxford from my Harvard days, but I haven't yet made contact with many people in London." "Good," thought Robin. "Here is a chance for me to find out a little more about the oil game and spend some time with a man who makes most of my patients look as if they had both feet in the grave. It might even shake me out of my lethargy." He continued, "Would you care to join me for lunch later in the week? You might like to see one of our antique London clubs." "How very kind of you." "Excellent. Will Friday suit you?" "It certainly will." "Then let's say 1 o'clock at the Athenaeum Club in Pall Mall." David returned to his city desk, picking up his tablets on the way. He took one immediately. He was beginning to enjoy his stay in London. Silverman seemed pleased with him, Prospector Oil was doing well, and he was already meeting some interesting people. Yes, he felt this was going to be a very happy period in his life.